Well, good morning, everybody. This is Anna Kay coming to you live on Universal Energy Radio with the show of the morning, What Makes You Glow. And I am thrilled to have Robin Hatcher joining us today from Speak Etc. to help us all be better public speakers and hear her story to entrepreneurship and whatnot. But first things first, hi, Robin, how are you?
Hi, Anna. I'm terrific. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. I should let everybody listening know that we just were bonding over our dogs because we both were taking our dogs out and making sure that they got what they needed. So hopefully they'll behave while we're doing our show today, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, Robin, I'm so excited. I've been perusing your website, and we actually met at a book event. So
right.
For authors and soon-to-be authors, we'll call them wannabe authors like myself. And I was just really struck with, and taking a look at your website, I know that it's something that you spoke about on a recent show. And it's all about your first impression, right?
Right.
So I'd love to get started with that because I'll share with everybody that my first impression of Robin was just confident and also really accessible. So you give off this great vibe of like knowing who you are and allowing the space for who other people are as well.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear.
Yeah, and that's tough to do, I think.
Yeah.
So I wanna get started with that, and you know, if you would talk a little bit about first impressions, and then I definitely want to get your story because I think it's interesting how everybody on the show comes to be where they're at.
Right. Right. I am distracted. So first impressions are incredibly, they take such a short amount of time. And first impressions can get begotten before anyone even opens their mouth, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I know that when I was a really shy individual, I spent a lot of time watching people
mm-hmm.
and seeing what was working and what wasn't working. And so what mm-hmm. I learned a lot was how to show up. And I feel like with me, it's not a natural thing. I love what you said about your impression of me because I feel like what it is like the yin and yang of me. You know, I have this very, very strong part of me that is out there. And in my book, I talk about actor types and the different types of personality and communication styles that you can have. And one of them is a hero, one of them is a buddy. And I'm a mix of those two. So
mm-hmm.
that hero in me is like it's a developed trait that I have that it was innately there and I've had to develop it. And the buddy who wants to really like people and be friendly and be friends with everybody in the world is also there too. So what happens with me is that I'm a blend of all of those and I have to keep them each in check so that both of them
mm-hmm.
show up to the party and one of
mm-hmm.
them doesn't outshine the other.
Mm-hmm.
Or because a buddy can really, if you're too much that type, can sabotage any business efforts that you want to make, you know?
Yes. I was just thinking that. I'm like, yeah, it's good to a certain extent.
Right.
Yeah, I just found myself in a conversation doing that same dance, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't being straight about what I wanted because I was being
yes.
a buddy.
Yes.
And at the end, I was like, you know, I just have to say something. I'm not interested in you just having a great event. I'm interested in being one of the speakers at the event.
Right. Good. For, yeah.
You know, and it was yeah. great. And the guy that I was talking to, who's an acquaintance slash, you know, getting to be friends, was like, thank you. Thank you for just being straight. And
yeah.
that won't work right now. I'm like, great. So at least
right.
you know. Exactly what I'm interested in, you
right.
know. But yeah, it was that same dance. I could feel myself pulling towards like, no, be nice. Don't you know, push the envelope too much. You're new, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that delicate balance. And I'd love to know more because I've, you know, been reading your website and I'm very excited to read your book as well. And what, talk to me about like the shy part of you, because I think that that's also really interesting because you have an acting background.
Right.
And so
I think I have an acting background because I was shy. What happened was that I was so shy.
I've seen that a lot.
Yeah, exactly. People, and that's why I love to do what I do, helping people express themselves and express the real them and you and get everything out, to really talk about your value, all of that amazing stuff that we all have inside of us. Because I feel like so many shy people do go into acting because they know they have something to give and they're crippled by some exterior or some internal emotional thing inside of them that makes it more difficult for them to express it in a day-to-day basis. So they go into acting so that they can express it some way or another. And that, I feel, is what happened to me. And from and then in a circuitous route and how I coach and train people is the route that a lot of actors take can also help in your personal and everyday life. So, for instance, for me, what made I don't know to this day whether it was nature versus or nurture that made me as shy as I was as a child, but I did not want to open my mouth. I just, first of all,
ever?
I didn't even I was like around
what
two,
age? Because I'm
sorry?
Really curious about. I'm really curious about.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. So
I've been
what
around
happened
kids
was
my whole
I was,
life, and my mom teaches 3-year-olds, so it's a subject in our family a lot.
Right.
Yeah. So when did you notice that, or when would do you remember?
Well,
you know.
Yeah. The interesting thing is you know children start to talk around one or two, and for me. I don't know if it was my ear or it was some other internal thing, but I wasn't forming words like that made any sense. I babbled, and I invented my own kind of words. So eventually what happened is my mother learned my vocabulary, and my sister, I guess, learned some of it. So that was from the ages around two or something, and I don't know what that was because there's nothing mentally and intellectually wrong with me now which would have made me want to do that. So I'm not sure if it was perhaps a choice that I made to not use the language that other people were using. I still, you know, to this day, it would be very curious to talk to a speech person to find out what that was all about. And so I babbled, and therefore no one understood me except for my mother for a while. And
so that's
then,
pretty limiting.
I'm sorry?
That's pretty limiting then.
Yeah, exactly. And then when I started to form words was probably around two, which is kind of late. And at that time, I guess that there was either a stigma already attached to me because I was – not only was quiet and as a baby, but I had an intensity about me that was a little bit different than my older sister, who was all out there. You know, she was talking and...
What's the age difference?
3 years.
Okay.
Yeah, so she was very verbal, was very attention-seeking, and I was the complete opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So what my family had come to... recognize in a child, and I also had an older cousin. It was a small family with not a lot of kids around. So I also had an older cousin who was very, very verbal and in his family. So what happened was people were looking at me like I was a little different. And that difference kind of stuck. And then I started to see the power in that difference because when you're quiet, people don't expect things from you and you can just observe. And since I had a very verbal family, the whole extended part of my family talked a lot. And so, again, that's where the nature versus nurture comes. Like, I didn't have a lot of room to talk, especially being the youngest. It's like, I'll just hang out. And it became a habit. And then I would get to places, and I didn't know. I would go to parties, and I would go with my family, and there was nothing I wanted to say. And there was... I didn't know what I was supposed to say. And now that you think about it, it's funny because you're asking me to think about things that I've never really spent a lot of time thinking about recently. But it was also one of those things that when people would want to talk to me, I felt like, it's not worth it. They're not really interested. And that's a trait that still hangs out a little bit, you know, it's like, because I was being treated as a child, and there was a part of me that didn't really feel like a child. So I didn't want to talk to them because then they would ask me deeper questions, which wouldn't make any sense to them. You know, it was just a very weird thing that I made that choice. And then people started scaring me because I didn't want to engage with them. And so at one of those parties, one of my uncles just started referring to me as shy. And then...
And what age was that?
Yeah, and then people started calling me shy. And
what age was that?
That was probably about four
mm-hmm.
or five.
Mm-hmm.
And and then they started, that was my nickname.
Really?
Yeah.
So
fascinated
by this.
I know. My family introduced me as shy. My mother signed Christmas cards with the name Shy for me. And, you know,
it was really
me,
the name. It was like not like
it was
a description you. It was your name.
It was my name. Yeah, for years it was my name. It's like people would, oh, how's Shy doing? And, you know, would meet people in the street and said, oh, this is my daughter Donna, this is my daughter Shy. At one point she even created a fancy spelling for it, you know, Shai.
Yeah, I was gonna recommend that one. Wow, that's really interesting. So I'm fascinated by this because public speaking is like a monster to people.
Right.
And it's so interesting to me. I do a lot of work with actors and was a pharmaceutical sales rep for years. Mm-hmm. And I've never personally had a fear of public speaking.
Right.
So I recognize that I'm an anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
And the exception, not the rule.
Right.
Because I've also done a lot of work through landmark education. Are
mm-hmm.
you familiar with that?
Yes.
You're familiar with that?
Okay. I am. Mm-hmm.
So for those of you who aren't as a personal development course, I've talked about it, you know, here and there on the show. But it's like very intimate sharing with large groups of people. So like
right.
AA without the alcoholism, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And so it's extraordinary to watch because I see it, you know, if I'm taking a course and I'll see it on a weekly basis, I see people that are just debilitated by their fear of public speaking. And just a quick story for you, my boyfriend is one of them.
Mm.
And it was in an exercise that we were doing through a course that we were taking that, you know, I kind of pushed him into doing, and he was not really thrilled with me. But he realized that his fear of public speaking came from having a speech impediment around 2 or 3 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so it's funny that you're saying this because I'm thinking it is almost a parallel story to what it was for him.
Right.
And then also he just stopped talking.
Right.
And became shy.
Yeah.
And It's the same thing, you know, except a little boy. And,
mm-hmm.
He recognized that he wasn't like everybody else.
Right, right.
So he shut down the verbal component.
Right.
And was like, you know, I think would agree, you know, at some point, like, is held back from in a career perspective and things like that because of this intense fear.
Yeah, yeah.
Know.
Yeah, those childhood traumas, I had a client like that as well.
Yeah.
The speech impediment is totally gone, but it's still, you know, it's still such a scar.
Right.
That
do you find that's something that is there for people? Like, I'm curious about this whole fear of public speaking. And,
right.
And in your experience, you deal with it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
What is it for people?
Yeah, it's interesting because some of it, I feel like the smaller percentage probably is for the trauma. I mean, a lot of people, and with people who are traumatized, it's like, you can make sense of it and you can understand it.
Yeah.
And then there are ways that you can then deal through hypnosis and NLP and just practice to get over it. The mm-hmm. other
what
psychologist,
percentage would you say that is?
I'm sorry?
What percentage of your clients is that actually a trauma?
Maybe half of 1%.
Okay. Small.
Yeah, because it's a very small percent. And I honestly, it's probably because the people that are totally traumatized have just left it off the table and won't even seek
mm-hmm.
Coaching or help.
I think of that movie, The King's Speech.
Right. Right.
You know, which was just so agonizing. You know,
yes.
It was really, it was
Definitely.
So sad to watch and also really exciting to see the transformation. But
right.
You can see how that can happen for somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's crippling. And mm-hmm. no matter how, and then that is interesting because there's so many personality types because there are other people out there that have all kinds of issues and don't feel anything about just getting up and speaking,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it's like I find mm-hmm. that totally fascinating. And
mm-hmm.
it may, you know, it may also have to do with their upbringing and how it was stigmatized.
Or if it was stigmatized.
Or if it was, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly, because some people are just more resilient because of how they were raised, or some people are more resilient just because of their DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So the and the
I think you bring up a great point also with your family that there wasn't a lot of space.
Exactly.
Because I know I'm the oldest and my sister is 2 years younger, and I think that she would agree with you.
Yeah.
And I was much more verbal. And,
right.
And there just wasn't that much space for her and for her opinions, and it acted out in a different way than it did for me.
Right.
Because I always felt heard, and you know, and she didn't.
Right.
So there's also a dynamic in families. But
definitely, birth order is very mm-hmm. commonly an indicator of it as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because and the thing is, we're trained, we're sort of raised, or neurologically programmed to want to also be different from the people around us. So that's another thing that happens with the birth order issue is that you want to be different from your sibling.
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes that difference is in, okay, I'm not going to talk like this. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. And
mm-hmm.
because it's a way of being individualized.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like, what was I saying? I feel like we're programmed to compete in a lot of ways. And we're also, the other percentage, I think you asked me, the other percentage of the people who have fear of public speaking is that psychologically and neurologically the studies show that it's because it is such a vulnerable thing. And it comes from the thing, it's like when you get up to speak, and that's why people say there are more people are afraid of speaking sometimes than death.
I saw that in your interview, and
yeah.
I was thinking, I think that's pretty accurate.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a vulnerability. You're standing up there, and you feel as though you're bearing your soul,
mm-hmm.
and somebody could take that soul and crush it. And I feel like that's the image that happens or the feeling that comes over people when they have that immense fear. And that is understandable in some ways, but what I try to do when I work with people is switch around your focus. And the reason why we feel so vulnerable when we're standing up in front of people is because our focus is also on us. We're worried about if they're going to like us, if they're going to, you know, take our souls and crush it. So what you want to do is you want to go on the offense and not the defense in a manner of speaking, which means that what I coach people and what I've learned and what you learn as an actor, because why it's easier for actors to get up on stage is because we have something to give. It's somebody else's words, but we want the audience to feel a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And as a public speaker, when we focus on what we want the audience to feel, then that vulnerability gets take that it's not as as scary. It's not there because our purpose is different. A lot of times people feel like their purpose is to get up and expose themselves. And that's scary. You know, nobody wants to stand up and take your clothes off in front of an audience. I know I don't. And so when you go on into a situation with that in mind, it's definitely going to be scary. It's going to be traumatizing. It's going to be nerve-wracking and anxiety-provoking. However, when you get on the stage and think, ah, I'm here because that person in the second row needs to hear what I have to say,
yeah.
That's a whole mm-hmm. different feeling.
Yeah, it's so true, and I think I'm thankful to have you on the show because I hope that it will inspire people to, you know, have some of their walls come down
mm-hmm.
around public speaking. Because I know, you know, while I didn't have a great fear of it, I also didn't speak from a place of like true authenticity before I started doing a lot of stuff with Landmark, and that went back to about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I would speak, but it was all from my ego.
Right, right.
So
yeah.
It was all to look good or convince people to, you know, do something that I wanted them to do. So I constantly felt icky about it.
Mm.
Because there was like this manipulation thing that I felt. Mm-hmm. And I was in sales as well, so I had some stigmas around that.
Right.
But it never felt great, although I knew I was good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's very different because I'm not consumed with the outcome.
Right.
I'm more interested in that it's landing for people.
Right, right.
And I think that's why this show is my favorite hour of my whole week.
Yeah.
Because I want people listening to get something that will make a difference for them.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole reason for all of this.
Yeah, excellent.
Is that in our sharing that it will make a difference for people
right.
and they will have a better life.
Right, right, right. Well, I want to say kudos for you for knowing that it was not authentic. You know what I mean? Because I feel as though a lot of people don't know and don't know the difference between being in your face and being authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a sign. It takes a lot of self-awareness.
Yes.
And maybe a lot of hearing, a lot of listening to things you don't like.
Right.
At least it was for me. It was not a great time looking in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
But worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, and one of the things that I do in my book is when I come up with when I talk about the nine actor types, they all have amazing strengths, but they all have what I call, also taking from the acting vernacular, is the fatal flaws. You know, every character in a movie, the only way that you can have a lead or an actor in a movie, because I was also a screenwriter and I knew and I had to practice and know all of the ways of really engaging an audience, is every character has a fatal flaw. And the movie usually centers around whether that actor is going to succumb to its fatal flaw or overcome its fatal flaw, you know?
So true, yeah.
And as speakers, as personalities, as communication styles, we all have these amazing strengths. And like what you were just describing is like you had an amazing strength of being able to speak, being very verbal, being able to be convincing and to sell. And one of the fatal flaws of that strength and that character is that they can be inauthentic and that they can not be vulnerable. And therefore, that's one of the things. So what you want to do is when you know that about yourself is to be able to get to that self-awareness, and so many people don't go there, can't go there, don't know how to go there, don't know that they need to go there. And so that's a great opportunity for shows like this, for people like this, or just in the world in general, to keep sharing the fact that, yeah, let's get the mirror out and look at yourself and see how you can elevate the way that you communicate so that you affect more people and affect more change.
Mhm. Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting. I had a really good friend, and she was pursuing an acting career in New York. Incredible singer and dancer. Like, incredible. I mean, she looks like Kristen Chenoweth and sounds like Aretha Franklin.
Gosh.
Phenomenal. Right, like she would open it. You're like, how did that come out of that little body? And she wouldn't get booked for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I first met her, I was like, it's not going to work. And that was my first thought. It was like, this acting thing is not going to work for you. And it was because I knew she was unwilling to go deal with some family stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that in dealing with that, that was the access point.
Mm-hmm.
Or because it was always the acting part. So she wasn't a trifecta, right? She was just singing and dancing, but then the acting part always fell short.
Right.
And that was always the coaching from her. And I remember her coming home one day and telling me about it, and I was thinking, yeah, because you don't want to go to the dark place.
Right.
In your own life. And how can you act it for somebody else's life?
Yeah, exactly.
And she went to work on that.
Yeah.
And is now in L.A. and booking things like crazy.
Oh, great.
But she went to the really, not so fun places.
Yeah. It's not, and that's why I love... I love a lot of these. I know some of them, so many of them are cheesy, but some of these reality shows on television, the competition reality shows, really are exposing that, because you can watch a singer or you can watch a dancer who is totally technically brilliant, but somehow is not bringing the emotional part to it.
Yeah.
And it, you can see it in an instant, and the judges pick up on it in an instant, and the audiences pick up on it in an instant. So it's so great to see. That's the good news about some of these reality shows, and I hope people are watching that part of it as well. Not that it's an easy, quick fix, but the amount of internal work that has to happen for somebody to be brilliant.
Well, and I would, and that's an interesting subject. And so this is kind of a circuitous show. And, I definitely want, I have a million things that I want to talk to you about, because this is all really fascinating to me. But I'm really interested in, can you guys hear that? This dog is out of control. My dog has a bone who is he's very excited about it. So I'm just going to shut this down. But that's something that I wonder about sometimes, because I think that can be true. But at the same time, when we're really living in our purpose, right, and coming from a place of like destiny, I mean, that can get people a bit funny. But, like, this is my life's work. This is my path. Like, this is what I know in my soul. I don't feel as though there's as much, not that there's not work, but it's not the same kind of effort. There's not that push or that force that's there.
So you're saying if people are doing what they are meant to do, that it's not as much, they don't have to do as much work to be brilliant at it?
Right.
Mm.
Would you agree, disagree?
That's interesting. I feel like there is a level of truth to that. However, I feel like it all requires work, because then if we don't continue to work, then we don't continue to grow in what we're brilliant at.
Yeah.
I don't mean it
in a not work kind of way. I just mean that, when you're out of alignment,
right,
and like nothing's working.
Right.
It's oftentimes because it's not supposed to work.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But it's interesting. And how do you tell the difference? That's always the challenge.
I know. Right.
That's always the challenge.
That's always the challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, because some of it is whether, am I in the wrong field, or am I doing the wrong thing, or am I not working at it, on it in the right way? And that is a sense of, I feel that you want to get really clear internally. I mean, so then the work is not about working on the work. It's about working on your conduit, your intuition, your you know, what makes you be able to feel things.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what it's all about. And it, for me, I feel like it's head over heart sometimes, because a lot of people will get things in their head that this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Well, that was how I lived most of my life. So it's
yeah.
it's a subject that I think about a lot, because, you know, and I was just talking, and I'm, you know, was in pharmaceutical sales for 10 years, lived in New York for 12, mm-hmm. and I was just talking to a 21-year-old senior in college, and she was saying, like, oh, you know, maybe I'll do this or maybe I'll do that. And I said, here's the deal. What's most important right now is that you know yourself.
Right.
Because if you don't, you're going to be selling drugs for a decade, hating it the whole time, but really wanting to do something else, but just trying to fit in and fit
right.
a mold that you think other people have for you.
Right.
So I'm just really conscious that people know themselves.
Yes. And I feel like, and I just had a flash when you were saying that, because yes, it's so important for you to know yourself. Know, and one of the things I talk about is know the values that you bring, but also the values that you live by. And so there are mm-hmm. lots of different assessments and tools and stuff that you can, and one that I mention actually in my book is Values in Action. It's like it's from the School of Positive Psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And to really know what values are important to you. Because what I'm realizing is that if you are really know yourself and know what your values are and know what value you want to bring to the world, you can almost do it in any profession. So
mm-hmm.
what you want to do is think, okay, what do I value? And then, yes, it's there are professions, there are careers, there are jobs or whatever that align more closely with those values. And that's great. And then sometimes you could say, oh, I have these values and I'm in this line of work. How can we marry those two things? And sometimes you can marry them. But with if you're just doing the work without knowing yourself and knowing what value you're bringing and what values you live by, it's not as fulfilling and it's not as effective.
Well, and I would say eventually it'll kill you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's strong language.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that intentionally so. Like, mm-hmm. the disconnect will be so great that you
right.
may as well not be here.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
and
like,
it,
we're going around like zombies.
Right. And it's unfortunate. It's like, because everybody can't do what they love. And I've had I've had opportunities to do trainings for government agency staff and companies like human services employees.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens, especially in the government, is they are told what to do. They are micromanaged. They are being led and supervised by people who are unhappy and therefore do not take it out on their staff. They take it up their unhappiness out on the people below them. And so these are miserable people. And
mm.
and they're very unhappy in their work, but they need a job. So, I mean, there are a lot of people like that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so I've
yeah.
had, you know, I've had these workshops that I've had to do to train. Like, one of them was dealing with difficult people, and it was all these government agencies. And I start hearing their stories and hearing their experiences,
mm.
and I'm just, like, floored and want to cry and go to their bosses and shake them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the things that I try to do with these individuals and in these classes is to dig deep and find a connection between the values that they have in their life and the job that they're doing. So that
mm-hmm.
a lot of people then feel like, okay, this is the job, I do this, 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 this. But what I do is I dig into their job and say, okay, by doing this, which may be a menial, ridiculous thing, are you not actually helping to save a child's life? Because if this were not done, then this, you know, so I really
right.
drill down into how this task that may seem menial and ridiculous and paper pushing is actually part of something bigger, and how they can start to look at it that way so that they can go into work with a sense of purpose and not mm-hmm. as a drudge.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny. It just hit me. So I'm in that experience right now in my own life. Where I'm assisting with the self-expression and leadership class at Landmark Education. And are you familiar with it?
No.
Okay. So it's a long class. It's 4 months, and it's a community. You create a community project. So in this class, a lot of businesses have been created, like Lululemon, the athletic company, was created in this class. So I'm used to taking the class or coaching the class, and because of some time stuff, I wasn't able to do either. So I decided to do production. Right. So that's interesting because it's not something that I've ever done before, and I'm doing it because my significant other is in the class, and it's terrible. I actually hate every minute of it. And I'm collating papers, and then I'm somebody's whipping boy, and I'm doing it wrong, and all, like, it's just constant. And the only way I can do it is to think about the service that I'm providing, and the space that I'm holding for the 50 people in the class to have a transformation in their life that they didn't think possible.
Exactly, yeah.
And same for my boyfriend. I said to him, I was like, I just want you to get, and this isn't, you know, something that I'm intending to make you feel bad about. I said, but every minute I think about how much I hate this and I don't want to do it, I think of you and how much I love you and how much I know this will make a difference in every aspect of your life.
That's great.
And
yeah.
that is why I'm here.
Yeah.
Because he's always like, I can't believe you're there so early and you're there so late. And I was like, do you get why I'm, like, what I'm committed to? And as a result, I'm able to do it gracefully with laughter and ease. And I'm, and it turned into this really great time.
Right.
But
yeah.
you're right. It's because I'm clear about why I'm there and what
exactly
I'm committed
what...
to from the value place.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's what I, you know, it's difficult for people and, who've been in this situation.
Not just once a week. I can't imagine doing that every day.
I know, exactly. And it's difficult. And I think, and they try, I hope that they try after, you know, I see them for maybe like a couple of hours sometimes or maybe 3 hours and I try to get this into them. But I hope that at some level it hits and they can do it.
So what is it? So we had talked earlier about people's fear of public speaking and the vulnerability piece. And that's something, you know, that comes to mind a lot. I'm sure that you're familiar with Brené Brown.
Yeah.
And her vulnerability talk.
Yeah,
you know,
that's great.
Now that I live in Houston, I'm just waiting to run into her. I'm very excited. but, like, how... are you able to help people overcome that? Like, where does that vulnerability piece fit in and you see that breakthrough for people?
Right. One of the things that you want, you know, speaking of Brené Brown, and I have to, I just was published in an anthology last year called Dancing at the Shame Prom. And
oh,
it's
I saw that. I love that.
Yes. And there are 25 or 27 women who wrote about shame in their lives, and like different varieties of shame, different levels of it. But and sometimes, it, and everyone experienced after we wrote that naming it. Once you name it, once you talk about it, it sort of lets it go, sort of dissipates it. So the thing about public speaking and shame and vulnerability is that once you, and that's why I videotape people in all of my sessions, because once you have that feeling of an experience, like the ultimate of, okay, this is me, I don't like it, this is it, blah, 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 get it out, oh, okay. And it's kind of like practice makes perfect in a way. Like the more you do it, the more comfortable you can become with it and the less precious it is. Because let's face it, sometimes our vulnerability, we hang on to it on purpose because it's so precious to us. You know,
yeah.
we don't want to let it go because it's something that we can cling on to and say, see. And we have to learn how to get rid of it because, let's face it, once you get rid of one vulnerability, something else is going to come up anyway. So, when I was asked to write in this anthology, there were so many things I could write about that were things that I actually dealt with already, you know. And so it's like, okay, am I going to cheat or am I going to go big? And so I chose to write about race and how difficult it has been for me to own the fact that I have added pressure of being an African-American woman in this society and how it showed up for me as a child and how it showed up for me and how it influenced and how it impacted the way I approach things, my level of intensity, how hard I worked, all of that stuff and all the shame around it that exists. And so in writing about that, I immediately saw a change in the way that I lived my life. And so I felt like I didn't have that fear of being called out on it because, hey, I called myself out on it.
You called yourself out on it,
Yeah. And so when we can do that and have fun with it, so a lot of times that public speaking fear is hiding one tiny little thing that we think people are going to pick up on and laugh about in us. And sometimes in a coaching session or a series of coaching sessions, I can get at that little thing of that person. And then it's like, you know, it's not that big. You know, it's nothing. And no one's going to see it, and your message is way more important than what you're trying to hide. You know, and some of it is like, it's not even, it's rarely a physical thing, but it's some sort of a limitation. They feel less, so many people feel like a fraud. And, you know, that's like the biggest feeling that everybody has. And it's like, everybody forgets that everybody else has that exact same feeling.
Yeah.
Or they don't realize that everybody has that same feeling. So you're standing up to, I don't deserve to be speaking. I don't deserve to be doing this. I don't deserve that. People are going to find me out. That's usually what is behind a lot of that vulnerability is people are going to find me out if I get up and speak. They're going to find out that I really don't know what I'm talking about. But you know what? Nobody knows 100% what they're talking about. You know,
I never know what I'm talking
about. They only know their heart. They know their intention. They know what they want to share and give to you. And that's all you can ask for somebody else, and that's all you can ask of yourself.
Yeah, it's so accurate. You know, that's when things really started happening for me. Like, even, you know, with this radio show and you know, quitting my job last year, and I went and did a yoga teacher training and moved out of New York, and, you know, just really flipped everything in my life upside down. So it's the opposite end of the spectrum now from where I was about a year and a half ago. And it all came from that place of vulnerability, but also of a deep faith and deserving. And it was only when I stopped, I wouldn't say that I don't care what other people think, but I don't let it run my life.
Right.
And I talked about this about a month ago when I met you, Robin, the day that I met you, I did an interview that morning and I was interviewed. And I talked about New York because my sister describes my relationship with New York like an abusive relationship. And she says, you know, New York would beat the crap out of you and then it would buy you dinner and a nice diamond necklace and you'd be right there again. So she would always talk about how New York is like my abusive boyfriend. because for 12 years it was this dance of like, okay, now I need to go. No, I'm not going. And, mm-hmm. you know, and it was never, I was never in the middle about the city. It was always like, I loved it intensely or I hated it intensely.
Right.
And I think about, New York as like an entity, as a being.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's great about it. And this is what I think people can take away from the city. And I'll be curious, since you live in the city, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Is that New York doesn't pretend to be anything that it is mm-hmm. or is not.
Mm-hmm.
It is exactly full of energy, full of life, full of dirt, full of smelliness. Like, it's all of it.
Right.
And it doesn't hide and try to fit in or look good for your parents or your teacher or whatever. Like, it is exactly how it is. And I would say that that's my greatest lesson that I've learned from mm-hmm. New York. And people are going to live there and love it, and people are going to never visit and hate it. Right. But at least you know where people stand when it comes to New York.
That's funny. I mean, as you were speaking, I started to laugh because Bloomberg is trying to change that so much. It's like there's so much beautification of Manhattan now. And I'm just wondering how that's going to affect, because I think you're right. It's like putting, flowers on a dead person. You know, it's like.
Yeah, I know. It's
you
weird.
Know, it's like you can dress them up, but you can't take them to dinner. So
it's
like you're making it, there are all these beautiful pathways. There's all these other things. There's the bike lanes. Yesterday in the 2 hours I was driving with my husband, we saw two accidents on bikes, one with the pedestrian, one with the car. You know, so it's like you can do all of this great stuff, and it is what it is.
It's frosting on a mud pie.
Right,
you're still going to smell the garbage.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the energy, the thing, and the other analogy that you can draw from New York is that it has all of these things, and you have to find out how to utilize them and make mm-hmm. them work for you, and how to avoid the distractions as well
mm-hmm.
When they're there. And there are several ways that you can do that and not get sucked in, because most people, what happens is they get sucked into the energy and it's like, oh, I have to be like this person. I have to be like this.
Oh,
I have to do this. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's a killer. And that's what makes New York so hard, because you're surrounded by so much. And there's just so many things distracting you and making you feel either awful, because you're walking down Fifth Avenue and there's no way that you can imagine paying the prices that people are paying for the things in the window.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're in some other part of town and people are lying on the street and you're thinking, oh, my God, I can't help all these people and I'm going to get robbed. You know, so
mm-hmm.
it's just, it really is a way, an opportunity for you to really have to know where you stand and where you are, and it can really beat you in the butt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was funny. I had, so you may know, Movies 101 at NYU, it's a film class mm-hmm. Taught by Professor Richard Brown. Yeah, Richard mm-hmm. Brown, sorry. I think his first interview was with Mel Brooks, and he's mm-hmm. just interviewed everybody. And he and I became friends. And I remember when I was leaving New York, I was, you know, very close friends with him, and we'd go out to lunch. And he said, you living in New York is always, you're always making it work.
Mm-hmm.
And my prediction is that being somewhere else, like Texas, you won't have to make it work as hard.
Mm-hmm.
It won't be as much work.
Right.
And for some people, it can work, and for other, and I was always very distracted with what was going on. And I think it's what led me into yoga. And
mm-hmm.
Even that, you know, wasn't enough. But I'm curious about those distractions and where that fits in with public speaking.
Mm-hmm.
and how you coach that, because, you know, I can think for myself, you know, you're speaking in front of an audience and you think things are going well and then something happens,
mm-hmm.
or gosh, you know, there's just that one person in the audience.
Yeah.
Totally.
You always focus on the one person.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how is it that you help people deal with those distractions?
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of things. I remember when I was writing my book, I addressed this. And one of the things that I said is, like, if there are two or three people in the audience that look bored, you ignore it. If
mm-hmm.
there's more than that, then, again, I mean, when I coach people, you have to be flexible.
Unless the audience is two or three people,
yeah.
in which case you should pay attention.
That's true.
Wait, pay attention to those people.
Yeah. So the flexibility is really, really important. And that's why when I work with people, it's like, you don't do a cut in the dyed-in-the-wool, etched-in-stone presentation. Never memorize a presentation. Never feel like you know exactly where everything is going to go, because you need to have the audience part of the conversation. And so I give, there are engagement techniques and audience involvement techniques that you can fill in the middle of your presentations all the time. You need to be flexible enough to go somewhere else if you see more than two or three people that are not engaged. And that, so it's really difficult when you have that one person in the corner working on the BlackBerry.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you have to realize is that you're not going to be all things to all people. The other thing that I noticed is that I have done presentations and fixated on that one person with the sour face, you know, in the back of my mind. You know, I don't fixate them. It's like, okay, how am I going to get this person? How am I going to get this person? And I do my presentation. I finish my presentation. That's the person that comes up to me afterwards and say, I really enjoyed your presentation.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing to realize is that you have no idea what a distraction really is. You really can't, hands down, 100% say that somebody is not engaged with you based on what you're seeing all the time. And the other thing is, like, if you do see that these people are distracted, ask a question. Get a show of hands. Do something that's going to bring them back into the engaged section of your presentation. And don't just keep talking, because it's really – and another thing that I've done, I've had a – I went to go do a training of teachers. And – I walked into the room, and three-quarters of the teachers had their computers open. And they were, I don't know what they were doing on their computers, but I stood and I talked for maybe 2 seconds, and I said, okay, wait a minute. I know you're all busy. I know you all have a lot to do. But if you need to be on your computer, then please, I really would prefer that you leave the room and do it. But if you're here in this presentation, I would like you to close the computer. And they all close their computer. But that's also something that we're going to have to learn how to do as presenters, because distraction, I mean, you can't talk to a computer, the back of the computer. It doesn't make sense. It's a face-to-face interaction. So I feel there are a couple of ways that you can deal with those kind of distractions. Call them out. Or use your own flexible audience engagement techniques to get them engaged again,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I tell people. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it's so true, because we are so we are not present.
Right.
And it's a big reason that I love yoga. Like, I don't care about anyone doing a handstand or a downward
mm-hmm.
facing dog. I could care less about that. What I am interested in is people being present.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a practice to be present. And I noticed it in the class last night that I was assisting, that the coaches were not present.
Mm-hmm.
And the class was, but in the back of the room, nobody was.
Hmm.
And I remember, you know, having coached this class before, one of the coaches said, we cannot expect participants to be present if we are not present.
Right.
Right. So we had a rule of, like, you walk into the room, your cell phone isn't on silent, your cell phone is off, mm-hmm. period. If you're not okay with that, you shouldn't be here.
You know, I ran into a friend of mine yesterday, and a fellow actor who's still doing a lot of acting, and he was telling me something that I never even thought about. You know, years ago when you're rehearsing for a play, you're present in the theater if you're on stage or you're off stage. He said lately what he's been experiencing is as soon as actors get off stage, they go on their devices. And he said that it's so disconcerting. So you're on stage, you're rehearsing with the director, and your classmates, your castmates, are off in the wings, hooked into some computer or cell phone mm-hmm. or iPad. Mm-hmm. And it's a whole different experience because what you're missing is you're missing the direction that your fellow actor is getting. You're not giving them that support. You're not, I can understand how it must be really disconcerting. I feel like directors should really not allow that.
Well, and, you know, I think of it all the time, and a term that I use a lot is holding the space.
Right.
Right. So even though I'm collating stuff in the back, I'm holding the space for transformation in people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm fully present to collating the papers, right? Or and same thing, and holding the space for your fellow actors.
Right.
And I've even been in presentations where it has been checked out, and, you know, in pharmaceutical sales, you're presenting to, you know, 50 nurses. And I flat out said, have you guys ever given a presentation where nobody's listening? And can you get with me on how shitty that feels?
Yeah.
And, like, what that does to you beyond this experience. Like, you walk out of the experience thinking that you're not valued, mm-hmm. that people don't listen to you.
Right.
And what are you doing with it? I mean, it may go into real crazy town, like, what am I doing with my life, blah, 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 blah. Like, I could I could get real crazy with it. And that's been a – and it's, and it again – when I pulled in the vulnerability piece,
mm-hmm.
that's the game changer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you get real with people.
Yeah, the people really need to – it's interesting. I take a lot of classes at my gym, a lot of exercise classes, and classes like Zumba. And yesterday this very interesting thing happened. The Zumba teacher walked in, and there were people having conversations, and she started wanting to start the class. And this happens a lot at that gym, but this teacher said something about it. And she said, I don't remember what she said, but it was something that made people realize that she was in the room. And then she actually said to one of the people that were having the conversation, she said, you know, when you become a teacher, you'll see what I'm talking about. Like, I hope you become a teacher and you see what I'm talking about. And, I mean, this is a lovely woman, and she doesn't do it with any malice at all. But that... And I'm so glad she said something, because it really does bother me. If a teacher walks into a room, it's that's the time to focus and, as you're saying, save space for what's next. It's not a time to continue a conversation.
Mm-hmm. I've done that with, and I have a yoga teacher that that does that in New York, Marco Rojas. If you get a chance to take his class, he's extraordinary. It's like therapy on the mat. And he said there is no talking. Once you enter that room, period.
Right.
And if you're not okay with that, you should not go to his class. And he makes that very clear. And
I love
funny,
that.
I was teaching a class the other day, and I was thinking somebody was talking, and I said something about it. I was like, once you enter these doors, this is sacred space.
Mm-hmm.
This is where people go to disconnect from their phones, to take an hour for themselves of peace and quiet. If you want to talk, I think that's great. I love it that you guys are friends. Do it outside.
Right.
So, yeah, I think, you know, being present is tricky now that we have such access to technology at all times.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a challenge.
Well, neat. Robin, I can't. I this could go on for the rest of the morning for me. But where can people find you? So Speak Etc., SPEAKETC.com is your website.
That's
with
my
your
website.
Book, Standing Ovation.
Yeah, Standing Ovation Presentations. And that you can find on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Mm-hmm. And I am on Twitter, Speak ETC. I'm on Facebook, both as Robin Hatcher and Speak ETC.
Mm-hmm.
And I love LinkedIn as well. And you can find
me
there.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
I don't use that as much as I will be, but yeah. And then any upcoming presentations or things that you're working on, things that you want to leave anybody with today?
Yeah, I'm rolling out a course. I'm rolling out a teleseminar in August, and it's going to be called Speak You. And one of the things, that when you go on my website, I have a quiz that I created in conjunction with the book.
Yeah.
And it's to find... I'm sorry?
I'm going to be taking that quiz right after this call.
Yeah. It's a really fun quiz. It's very quick. And what you do is you answer a few questions and you find out what your actor type is. And then I send you a very brief summary of the actor types and your qualities and some of your fatal flaws and some of my director's notes of how to elevate your fatal flaws.
Go on and get on the site. I'm going to have to end the show, unfortunately. But, Robin, we love you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. This has been such a treat. And check her out at speaketc.com, and you can see the recording of the show at youglownow.com as well. Thanks, Robin.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye, guys.